Welcome to Dave Ramsey's Entree Leadership Podcast. This is the place to learn what Dave Ramsey and his team teach about leadership and business. On today's show, you're going to hear Dave talk about what to do when failure is caused by leadership. We also have a great interview with Tim Sanders, who is the former Chief Solutions Officer at Yahoo. He's also author of the New York Times bestseller, Love is the Killer App, How to Win Business and Influence Friends. Who am I? My name is Chris Licurdo, and I am your host for the Entree Leadership Podcast. What can you expect out of the podcast? As always, our goal is to grow you. Our goal is to teach you something, show you something that you're not currently doing. Grow your leadership, grow your business, grow your team, whatever we can do. But we don't want it to be one way. We want you guys to interact as well, and we have had a lot of interaction, which is great. There's a couple ways you can do this. The first way is on Twitter, at Entree Leadership. That is at E-N-T-R-E Leadership. You can also interact with us through email at podcast@entreeleadership.com. Now, what we're looking for, we want your comments. We want to know what you think about it. We want you to tell others about it. You guys have made this an incredible podcast. We have stayed at the top of the charts for many, many weeks, so we really appreciate that. But we want you to let your friends know that it's out there. But we want to hear from you. We want to know what your questions are. We've gotten a lot of questions. Some of those we're going to be answering throughout the podcast, and a lot of those we're answering on my blog at chrislicurdo.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Chris Licurdo. Now, the lesson that we have coming up this week is about failure. There are three sources of failure, and we will focus today on when team members fail because of leadership. So, sit back, get ready. Here is Dave Ramsey on failure.
Now, what happens when team members fail? Let's look at subtracting for a minute. Team members eventually have to perform, or eventually they have to leave. The first thing you want to do is you need to determine the root cause of their lack of performance. And you need to stop and be very thoughtful about that. There are only three possible root causes of their lack of performance. There really is only three. The first one is a leadership breakdown. It's your fault. Leadership breakdown has been the cause of us losing half of our people. Not in recent years. In recent years, we lose almost no one due to a leadership breakdown. But in the early days, half the people we lost or had to fire were our fault. And it goes back to this. If the problem is leadership, fix it. That's the good news. You know, you're the problem, and that's the bad news. The good news is you're the solution. You can fix this. That's a variable you can control. Becoming an Entree Leadership, learning the stuff we're learning today, doing this stuff, that's a variable you can control. And so if you figure out there's a breakdown inside your organization that caused someone to fail, then you need to fix that and have one of those, we never do it that way ever again because it doesn't work things. You know, it can be something as simple as I discovered a few years ago, we were growing so quickly that people would come on board and it would be like 2 or 3 weeks before they had a telephone or a computer, which means they're like worthless and disillusioned. They're so excited. They got the new job and they come in. They can't do anything. Nobody even knew they were coming. They're not prepped for. How disheartening. During the honeymoon. Oh, nasty bad. I don't want to do this. And so I went to the IT guys and I went, what is your problem? How is it we have new people that I'm paying money to that can't do anything because you don't have a phone and you don't have a computer? And they said, How is it that somebody inside this company doesn't know that it takes 3 weeks to get computers in and get them built when you're doing them on the volume that we're doing them? And we have to order phones to get them in here and get them plugged in. Maybe HR ought to let us know. And I went to HR and I went, how is it that IT doesn't get notice from you 3 or 4 weeks ahead, making sure that you know that they know that you're getting ready to put somebody in that workstation and they're not sitting there useless? And they went, well, that's true, but how is it that the position was budgeted for and nobody ever told us until the hire was made? And so we had a little breakdown in the chain of events here. We had all these three people trying to do their jobs, people running departments, people hiring the people to run the departments, and people doing the tools. And so we had to kind of start working together. We had a little communication meeting, didn't we? We said, okay, as soon as the position is budgeted for, order the computer. Even if we're not going to hire them for 5 months, go ahead and get the tools to make the deal. That's a leadership thing. I can fix that. I don't have to have somebody disillusioned. That's the deal. Did you hire someone who didn't fit the position? You get them in there and you go, oh, Like those two ladies I talked about, we switched them from personal assistant to customer service and back and forth. And we put them in there and they didn't fit the position. And we thought they did after all of that, but we put them on the seat on the bus. And, you know, if you read Good to Great, this book, you'll get to that chapter. It is one of my favorite chapters in Jim's book. It is the good companies, the companies that go from good to great, get the right people on the bus, the wrong people off the bus, and the right people on the right seats on the bus. And so you look for a different position inside the organization if you put them in the wrong position. And next time, you are more thoughtful in your interview process about who we're putting in there. And you don't make that same mistake again. Learn from your mistakes as leaders, as entree leaders. I've had to do that. I've made a lot of mistakes. Were they given the tools to win? They didn't have their computer. They didn't have their phone. They didn't have their cell phone. They didn't have the connections. They didn't have their email set up. Those are basic tools, right? But other tools could be that you weren't there to mentor them. You didn't do what you were supposed to do. Are they standing there with a shirt going, "Who's going to take my money?" Bad customer service. You're not a micromanager. You're a servant when you onboard them properly and get them on board and teach them and work with them and spend hours pouring into them in those first 90 days. Those first 90 days are so key to getting people a good start. Where are the objectives? The KRAs, clear. That almost never happens in our organization because I am death on these KRAs because I did it wrong so many times, and then I had people so confused about what their real job was, and it blew up in my face so many times. But about 2 years ago, I had this happen. One of my VPs brought a guy on, and guess what? The VP was not a high C, high D. Busted through, getting the hire done, moving too fast, didn't even have the KRAs done. I look up 6 months later, and he keeps coming to me telling me his new guy's a joke. This new guy he hired, he's going to have to fire him. And I'm like, well, so let's talk to him. And so I went in and sat down and said, so what is it that you're supposed to be doing? And he started telling me, and the VP's looking at me with this weird look on his face, and I'm going, so apparently that's not his job. Well, let's get your KRAs out of the file. So we went and got his file and pulled out his key result areas. He didn't have any. That's a leadership failure. That's not the guy's fault. That's a VP getting ready to get a butt chewing. That's what that is, right? Totally wasted opportunity. Almost let a guy go because of his failure. Absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Were the conflicts left unresolved? If you've left them in a paralyzed position and therefore they're not performing, that's your fault. Because you didn't cleanse these wounds. You didn't fix it. You have the opportunity to save these people by putting them in an environment where they can win.
Okay, so do me a favor and put your hand up if any of those apply to you. Okay, not if you're driving. Keep your hands on the wheel. Here's the thing. As leaders, we have got to understand that sometimes we're the reason why people fail. Sometimes we're the problem. And as I teach and coach leaders over and over again, the thing that I constantly tell them is this. It is your job to make your team successful. So many times I see entrepreneurs that will hire somebody, put them in a position, put them in a role, and give them a job to do, and then walk away. And 30, 60, 90 days later, when the job isn't being done correctly, they sit back and go, well, crud, I guess I must have hired somebody bad. I must have hired somebody who can't do the job. No, you weren't there to make them successful. If they are failing, did you do everything you possibly could? Did you give them every single tool that they needed? Were you there micromanaging them on a good way, on a good level, asking them, do you have any questions? Do you have anything that you need? Is there anything else that I can do? Do you completely understand what it is that you're supposed to be doing? If not, then don't be surprised when they fail. Now, Chris Mefford, our producer in the booth, Chris, you had a situation. I had brought you on. You had hired an assistant, had been working for you for a little time, but this kind of, you had a situation around this as well, right?
Yeah, cause I came into your office and I said, hey, I hired Krista and she's been here about 6 months and it's not working out. And you looked at me and you said, well, it's your fault, not her fault.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, you're crazy. But, you know, looking back, I was the problem. She needed lots of detail and I wasn't giving it to her. And when I started giving her more detail, she started to thrive and succeed. And so as a young leader in the company, learning that I was the problem as opposed to just blaming someone else, that was a big entree leadership step in my life.
Mm, absolutely. And if I remember correctly, now obviously she went on. I say obviously as if everybody listening to this knows that. She did go on, but I think from that point forward, that was a world of change in y'all's life out there. So folks, that's the thing you've got to understand. You've got to know when leadership is failing or when failure is happening, what is your part in it? What do you need to take responsibility on? What do you need to jump in and fix right away? All right, up next, the Tim Sanders interview. This you're going to love. Tim has valuable experience in cutting-edge businesses, sales, and marketing. He's weathered the quality movement as well as the dot-com crash and emerged with precious insight. I mean, this guy has got crazy amounts of information stored up in his brain, but also in books, which are incredible, the stuff that he's written. He was the chief solutions officer at Yahoo and later their leadership coach. His newest book is Today We Are Rich, Harnessing the Power of Total Confidence. Helping us out with the interview is John Acuff. John is a part of the speakers team here at Dave Ramsey's organization. He's written three books himself. One of those, his newest one, Quitter, is a Wall Street Journal bestseller. So here is John with Tim Sanders.
Tim, it is awesome to have you here today. We are just really excited to talk about accountability and your expertise in that and hear your thoughts on how employees and employers can take better accountability and responsibility for their actions.
John, great to be with you. One of my favorite topics in the world.
Well, awesome. Well, the first question I have, we often see leaders that have kind of a poor me mentality, and they let their team get away with that as well. It becomes kind of toxic to the environment. For instance, when is that department going to do its job? Or why don't they communicate better? Or who dropped the ball? How can leaders handle this kind of environment in their own heart and how it spreads to their team?
There's a few things that are real important to think about when it comes to this poor me and why are they doing it. Habit. First of all, here's the impact on the environment. The culture is a conversation. You know, I've always believed that a corporate or an organizational culture is a set of values and an outlook that is communicated by leaders. And that set of values and that outlook on people creates an intuition amongst the entire group. I tell leaders all the time, you need to understand that your people look up to you and they want to be you when they grow up. And they copy everything you do. And when I see a culture of fear and victimization, that fish stinks from the head every single time. So remember, leaders, what you project on that movie screen is the reality of your people. So you can't personalize failure. Failure is an object. Success is a destination. We have to stop making it about people, and we have to start making it about the mission. One of my favorite guys that runs a company that gets it right is Dr. Jim Goodnight. He is the founder and CEO of SAS Institute in Cary, North Carolina. They are this year's number one best company to work for, according to Fortune magazine. They've done this a couple of times. Goodnight talked to me about a story about a real failure in a product launch. In the software business, when you fail on a launch and you miss the window, bad things happen. You lose customers, you lose momentum, sometimes you lose talent. So he said one day he decided to take, quote, the air out of the ball because a lot of people are talking about, why did you do this? Why do you people always do this? And it becomes very, very defensive, you know, in terms of the environment. It creates a negative mood state. So what he did, he brings everybody in, sits them all around a table, and there's a box in the middle of the table, okay? That box is the container of failure. Everybody brought in an artifact, maybe a disc that some of the code was on, maybe a memo that talked about when it should have happened, maybe a report, maybe a packaging demo. And as everybody comes into the room, they're putting an item in the box. Spin the box around, starts with the first guy, take something out of the box and tell us how you feel about the thing. By the end of the meeting, it was about the things. The deadline, the code failure, the delay of a third party in packaging, the delay of a third party in a distribution. And what they all kind of realize is that they're in this thing together. And he says that what you're doing is you're resetting. And you're allowing people to understand that we make mistakes. And this has been a big mantra for me. It's okay to make mistakes, just make new ones.
That's great.
So what I worry about in terms of accountability are, to use a phrase from Raising Arizona, repeat offenders. Now, if I'm going to get emotional, what I get emotional about is recidivism. Same mistakes being made over and over again, okay? Now, that's a person who's not accountable. That's a person who's not taking away the lessons from failure. That's a person that we're going to have to sit down and have a conversation about whether they fit in our culture, right? Because the culture is about accountability. What is accountability? Accountability is about getting an idea to market, mm-hmm. right? Accountability is not coming up with a new idea because the old one failed. Accountability is the stitching the very last 2%. And so this victimization culture that you see throughout organizations, I just believe that's a person's got the blinders on, and they're going to hit a wall if they don't watch out.
Well, one of the things that I think happens sometimes in companies is that you move so quickly that you jump from a project to a new project to a new project.
Life in the projects.
And you never do a lessons learned. And you keep repeating those same things because you've never paused and said, let's do the table moment. Let's do the kind of breakdown. And so we don't repeat those. How do you build that kind of time, that kind of commitment into your culture?
So one of my leadership things has always been, don't make excuses, make up lost ground, right? But people make excuses when they get on the defensive, right? So what we have to do is stop threatening people's safety, economic safety, social safety, reputational safety. We got to stop threatening people's safety and start bringing people in on the team and helping them realize something very important about business. This is something I learned from my first real influential CEO, Tim Kugel, Yahoo. He said, the company's a little baby. We got to take care of the baby. You let the baby cross the street by itself, bad things happen. Whether that little baby's 3 years old or 70 years old, companies never grow up. We got to be accountable for the baby. We got to take the emphasis off the people and their failures and put the emphasis on protecting the baby, because the baby is the future for all of us, and we all know nobody puts baby in the corner. The other thing to think about here is that we have to understand the leader's role. And of all definitions I've ever heard, the best one I've ever heard comes from Napoleon Bonaparte, who was the Yogi Berra of military leadership. He once said that the leader's role is to define reality, then give hope.
And that sets the perspective.
It sets the perspective. So now postmortem isn't a he said, she said blame session. When a project either succeeds or fails, the postmortem is a hope generation session, right? So the postmortem is about identifying the reality. Did we hit our metrics? Is this a center of excellence? Did we meet expectations to the external stakeholders? Okay, that's reality. And then we need to draw a line and say, then that is set. There's nothing we can do to go back in time and change reality. Let's talk about hope. And hope is, how are we going to improve over time? And how are we going to let this be a constructive experience instead of a destructive experience? And I think that's the challenge to leaders. And you need to build in 5% to all projects, just like I build in 10 minutes after every meeting to identify and confirm all the promises I made in that meeting. Because that's really important, promise keeping.
Now, do you do that in the meeting, or is that something you do when you're back in your space alone?
So I'm going to share a little leadership thing I do. It's a little trick. So the trick is, when I take notes in a meeting, the first page of the notes, of course, there's the heading of the meeting and the date and the participants. I take the first page and I fold it over vertically to reveal the back. I only write on front side of pages. There's a reason for this. So I fold it over and the back is now revealed to me. That's my promise ledger. So when I'm in a meeting and I promise to do something, stop, I write it down. And I write down a deadline. That's really important too. Dr. Norman Vincent Peale said that promises are like crying babies in a crowded theater. They should be carried out at once.
That's great.
So if I don't say I'll get back to you next Wednesday, I'm going to get back to you when the meeting's over with, okay? So I write down the promises and the deadlines, and then I just leave myself a few minutes after a meeting to construct an email if I have access to a computer at that time. And it goes out to all the participants. It says, here's what I heard myself promising. Please confirm these expectations. And then it goes out to my administrative assistant, who schedules it just like an appointment, pops right up. I live a life of keeping little promises, because anybody can keep the big promises, but leaders keep the little ones, because you will be judged as an accountable leader and create a culture of accountability based on the little things you kept doing, even when conditions changed.
Well, one of the things that I've heard Seth Godin talk about before, scalable promises.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that there are times where you might be able to answer every email when you've got three people that are interacting with you. But as it gets larger and larger, you have to think about, what are my promises? Where are they scalable? Where do they grow? Where do they change? So you're interacting with tons of people. We've got leaders that are saying
700 emails yesterday.
700 yesterday.
Yep. I'll be up all night tonight.
So how often are you answering every email?
Yes.
Have your promises changed as a leader now over the years?
No. I find that my interaction over email is my ministry as a leader. It's my commitment. I learned this from Mark Cuban, who answers exponentially more than mine. He posts his email address by the scoreboard at American Airlines Arena. It's my way of keeping in contact with people. There's stuff I don't do, John. I don't do meetings over 45 minutes. I don't sit around and try to build consensus so that I'm not on the hook for anything. We make decisions, we move forward, okay? I don't take bad trips. I'm not talking like drugs.
Sure, yeah, sure.
I mean like vacation, you know, trips to go see people. So I'm very conservative with my time, so I have time on email. But let's talk about scale a little bit. Every person has a different scalability, okay? What we have to learn is to appreciate the challenge of scale. So frequently we can say, I have a guy that can help you. I can do this. I can do that. And we overpromise ourselves. And then what we do is we break all those promises and tell people I don't have time. Okay. You want to solve scale problems in your life? Try keeping a promise that you never should have made in the first place that will wreck you to keep. I did that. Yeah, I used to always help people get money for their startup. I could help you. I'm going to help you. It was happy talk. And then one day I realized that I was starting to let people down because you can't always get people money. And they're writing a business plan is really hard. Selling a business plan to vulture capitalists is really difficult, right? So I picked this one guy, and I was like about to let him down. I said, nope, Tim, you made a promise. Keep it. And boy, was it hard. And we worked for 2 weeks on this proposal. We went out and met with people. And at the end of the day, the guy gives up and goes back to work, okay? But I learned something very valuable, and I learned it at the most primal subconscious level. Tim, stop saying I know a guy. And I learned how to scale by experiencing the pain of keeping a promise I never should have made in the first place. So, you know, that's a good experience for all leaders to do. And it's just so easy to say, things have changed, guy. I can't do what I promised. But a painfully kept promise, man, that'll change your life.
Well, and how and which promises you make. And not, like you said, the happy talk. I think sometimes the temptation is to say, I can help you in the conversation, because you want to be liked. You want to be able to say yes, mm-hmm. and be the person that says yes and offers promises. And then in the quietness of the day, when the reality of the promises stacks up, that's where I think...
Hashtag helping. You know, that's mm-hmm. the leader's mantra. You know, it's not about winning. It's about, hashtag helping. Mm-hmm. I'm helping everybody. You can't help everybody. You'll help nobody. You know, so I think the idea then, you know, around this accountability is also delegation. Tom Peters taught me something really valuable early on in his mentorship of me. He said, in every project, you need to elect a vice president of the last 2%. And if possible, it's a she and maybe a mom, because they're better at it than any other creatures on this planet. And they own this. And they are allowed to pester and hassle anyone, including you, to keep the last 2%. That's all they own. They call it the law of the last mile. The law of the last mile started out in the telco business. Basically, it goes like this. If they can't get the fiber to the house, there's no dial tone. And to the consumer, if there's no dial tone, the phone company's not in business. So the last mile is way more important than the power plant. The last mile is way more important than the marketing plan. The last mile is the reality check of a leader's promise.
That is great. And that's something that, for me, I'm seeing happen in different cultures. And it's very interesting to think about where your promises are made. One of the things you wrote in your new book, Today We Are Rich, that I really liked was about the story of you singing and going to sing and the advice you got about nuts. Can you explain that a little? Because I think the criticism, the accountability, I think that's all wrapped together.
Yeah, we give up in the race a lot because we hear criticism and then we say, I'm a failure. And we just say, then what's the use, right? Or we don't do things the second time because the first time we got negative feedback and it changes our self-image. Okay, so when I was a kid, I wanted to be a singer. Always wanted to be a musician. And my first crack at public performance was at Singing Hills Church Camp. I probably third grade or something. I don't know. It's still in grade school. And I was still in special education. You have to understand this from the backdrop. So, you know, you're not in the general population in school, but in church, you're in the general population. You're short bus kid, but you're still in the general population. So we go to Singing Hills, and it was a coming out moment for me. I sang Fill My Cup, and I was behind the piano playing, and I did take advantage of preaching a little bit before I sang, because I was that kind of kid. I think I talked 4 or 5 minutes about something. And then I sang my song, and a bunch of other kids from Albuquerque and Santa Fe came up afterwards, and they were just like, man, I love your voice. I loved what you had to say. And it's the first time I'd ever received praise, and I was full. Fill my cup, I was. Then I got on the bus with the other kids from Clovis, and they started picking on me. Some of them called me... They said, short bus, you were an embarrassment. Your clothes are homemade. Because my grandma made all her clothes out of remnants that she'd buy for a quarter here, a quarter there. So we didn't know that there was anything wrong with that. I thought I was the coolest kid in school until I heard that. Then another said, your voice is so high, you sing like a girl. They called me Squeaker on the bus. And then even our sponsor, Gil Johnson, said, son, don't you ever preach before you sing again. You weren't invited to preach. You're not the elect. And I was in tears. And when I got home, I told my grandmother, Billy, I will never sing in church again. She pulls a pecan out, and she says, Tim, would you eat this thing whole? And I said, of course not. I couldn't even swallow it. She cracked it open, you know. She handed the nut to me, and she says, criticism to your face is a gift. She goes, it's like this nut. I took the nut and I put it in my mouth and I chewed it. She says, you can eat that nut, can't you? I said, yeah. She says, it's nutrient. She said, how about these shells? Can you eat these? I said, no way. They'd hurt going down and coming out. She said, that's what criticism's like. Every piece of criticism you receive to your face is a gift because inside it is a nut. That nut is an insight, sometimes about you and sometimes about the people in your life, the source of the criticism. She said, those other kids were jealous of you. They don't understand you. And that's what the way they came from. It's not about you. I said, but what about Gil Johnson, our sponsor? He's a good man. She says, Gil Johnson was right. You're not Steve Allen. They asked you to sing a song, not give a homily. Don't ever do that again. You've learned a valuable lesson. And it changed my life. So she said, remember, eat the nut, dump the shells. And my entire life, I've thought about that, not just for criticism, but for failure. It's like, what's the lesson? And where's the garbage can? And that'll change your perspective on life, and it'll help you keep moving forward, regardless of the people that you hang out with or the mistakes you may make.
Well, and I think that's part of what helps make an accountable environment. Sometimes leaders, I've heard people say, the higher up you go, the less honest feedback you get.
Yeah, it's like whack-a-mole. Leadership is extremely dangerous.
And people don't want to give you sometimes the things that aren't fun to hear. They want to say yes to the ideas, the emperor's clothing idea of, okay, we only want to bring good news to the leader. We don't want to get in trouble. How do you create and foster an environment where people can be honest and give criticism where criticism's needed, even as it's going up the ladder, up the chain of command?
Well, I believe we have to learn to take the emotions out of business. So if a person actually can go to you and say, we are really in trouble on this project, you need to be able to start with a concept of solutions, right? So somebody comes to you and says, I got some negative news for you about what's going on. I think I'm failing on a project. You need to first say then, okay, what do we have to work with? Help me understand what we can do to solve the problem. And you need to shift the conversation from failure and blame to solutions and assets. It's gonna create a safe place. Bill Hybel at Willow Creek always talks about how we need to extend umbrellas of grace to people, to be honest with us. So the real concept is you're never going to get in trouble for telling me the truth, but we're all going to get in trouble for failing on the mission. And the umbrella of grace says that a good leader can actually give a person a safe place to tell the truth. And I think it's a powerful idea in leadership. You know, the last thing is that people do what they're compensated for doing. So truth-telling and promise-keeping were always about 10% of annual compensation for the people that reported to me. I messed around a lot with compensation. I wasn't foolish enough to say that you should just be paid on how much money you brought in. That can't be more than 50%. Otherwise, we create money changers, you know, in an organization. So I always had, like, soft stuff. Like, 10%, can I depend on you to tell me the truth and other people are lying? I call it truth-telling. 10% promise-keeping. And then 20% happiness promotion. Because I realize that if the people aren't happy, they're not smart because it's a chemical issue. And that for most engineers, I worked at Yahoo, their entire job was Yahoo. So you know what? The manager owned happiness. If your people aren't happy, then it's your fault. Boy, that's your change management style. It caused people to walk around and ask, how are you doing, instead of what are you doing? Caused leaders to take Friday afternoon and catch people doing something right, instead of stomping around on Monday, catching doing something wrong. So compensation fixes a whole lot of this stuff in the mix.
Because people start acting that way.
They go home with their paycheck and they start talking about this wacky stuff that they either did or didn't make their bonus on. And all of a sudden, the significant other gets on the team and it just changes the way they behave. You know, fix the money, fix the problem.
Have you seen accountability become infectious outside of the office too? So that when somebody engages with that, when they're connecting to that, it spreads to the other chapters of their life?
Execution is contagious, you know, and it's also highly addictive. It's like when you get into the habit of finishing things that you start, it begins to give you an incredible sense of self-worth. It gives you a tremendous sense of personal integrity. And all of a sudden, you start to say things like, when we start things in this family, we finish. When we start things at church, we're going to finish. When I start things at the nonprofit, we're going to finish. Execution becomes a preferred lifestyle once you adopt the difficult steps that it requires.
Well, Tim, one of the things I've heard you say a number of times, and you talk about it in Today We Are Rich, is leaders are readers. And what are you filling yourself with is one of those ideas I've heard you talk about. What are you right now filling yourself with? What are some books you're excited about, some leaders you're looking at, some resources that you're digesting?
Just finished a book by Timothy Wu called The Master Switch. The Master Switch is a book about AT&T, and it's basically the concept of who owns the master switch for information owns the nation. And it suggests that the master switch may be owned currently by Google and in the future by Facebook. So it's a book about information monopolies. And in the business I'm in, that's really important to understand the history. going back to the telegraph, of where the monopolies really exist, where the government always gives one company the rights to all information and what that really does to a culture. It's kind of cool. On a professional level, too, I'm just finished reading Tell to Win by Peter Gruber, movie maker, Mandalay Entertainment. It's a fantastic book about the power of telling stories, but more importantly, how to tell a story that actually is a vehicle for emotional transportation. And in my business, that was pretty cool. So finishing that, and I'm actually going to go back and reread James Allen's As a Man Thinketh, published in 1921, based on Solomon. It's real important because the thoughts that dominate our mind are going to run our reflex system, and I want to get back in touch with that again.
Well, one of the things you've said to me before is about how important that first 30 minutes is in your day.
Right.
How that kind of is the slingshot moment that launches you into the rest of the day.
I like that slingshot moment. It is. It establishes your metabolism. You know, breakfast is the most important meal, not because you're hungry, but because it tells your body how to digest and process stuff the rest of the day. That's why it's bad to get up and eat sugar and carbohydrates, good to get up and eat protein, right? Well, for your mind, it's the same thing. You get up in the morning and you think thoughts of gratitude about your team and fill yourself with confidence-building material, and it's an expansive concept. It gives your mind a chance to slow down and believe. That's why it's important to read books in the morning and not email, because you read books at a fraction of the speed. It's like eating slowly and chewing your food. And I think that's really, really important. And I also think that leaders have a spiritual connection, too. I think that's why it's important to get up and meditate or pray in the morning, too. We've got to remember we have three metabolisms: our body, and our mind, and our spirit. And as Dr. Norman Vincent Peale says, you need to wake up like a bird, slowly.
Well, that just about wraps it up. One last question. Speaking of Today We Are Rich and books, looking on Amazon, lots of 5-star reviews. How is this book connecting with people? What are you seeing the reaction as people engage with this content?
You know, Today We Are Rich is about lessons my grandmother taught me based on surviving the Great Depression. And I think a lot of people that are responding to this book realize they're not alone. And they realize that rich isn't about your bank account balance and the P&L strength at a company or in a household. It's about the difference that you make. And people have always thought, you know, I want to make meaning, I don't want to make money, whether they're the CEO of an organization or just a parent. And I think it's validating for a lot of people. And I just want to let the listeners know that if you're marching towards purpose in your business or your personal life, you are successful because of what you're doing and not despite what you're doing. And there's something else I said in the book that people really react to, and I said this at Catalyst, and that the things you learn on Sunday make you a rock star on Monday. Don't ever forget that.
That is awesome.
So I tell people, go to work and make fish, as they say in the 60s.
Nice, nice. Well, this has been a blast. I feel like we could probably do this for 5 hours. We certainly don't have that window, but where are the best places for people to connect with you? Connect with your content, connect with you online.
So here's the thing. Go to twar.com. That's the initials of the book, twar.com. Mm-hmm. You can download a free ebook, Feed Your Mind Good Stuff. I think that's a really good start. And you can email me. I'm tim@timsanders.com.
Well, and you know he's going to respond. We've talked about that today, about promises and accountability.
Yep. So I carry around a gift in my bag, and I've been carrying one around now for 3 months. If anybody ever walks up to me and says, dude, I emailed you, you never replied, I pull this gift out. It's usually a good book or the book I'm reading, and I just give it up, and that's the way it hurts. I gave up a signed copy of Outliers last year to a guy that said, you never responded. I don't know what happened, because I don't use filters. But I pulled it out, had a signed copy of Malcolm Gladwell Outliers. Boy, that hurt. Not going to see that Afro guy for a while, man. So it's like, dang. You know, when I did that, I said to myself, Tim, you got to answer all your emails. Stop watching so much basketball.
Oh, that is great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Tim Sanders, pick up the new book, Today We Are Rich. Great, great book. I'm reading it right now. Thanks so much for joining us, Tim.
Couple of great things out of that interview. First of those is, it is okay to make mistakes. Just don't keep making the same ones. If you're going to make a mistake, make a new mistake. Do something new. Learn from the mistakes that you're going to make. And it's so funny in business. I keep meeting people over and over again at our events and coaching them. And mistakes seems to be one of the things that people hate. Well, of course, you should hate it. It's a mistake. The problem is that if you're not making mistakes, you're not doing anything. If you're not making mistakes, you're not bumping into anything. You're not moving things around. You're going to make mistakes. Accept that part of it. But the part that you need to do is make sure that you're not making the same mistakes. Also, I loved when he said leaders keep their little promises. You know, we don't have a hard time keeping the big promises because we know that it stands out. We know that everybody's got their eyes on us when it's a big promise.
but you need to keep the little promises. Hey, I'm going to be there on time. Hey, I'm going to get that email out to you in the next 30 minutes. Hey, I'm going to whatever it is. As you don't keep those little promises, guess what? Your team is watching it, and they know it, and they feel it. And while you don't think that it means anything to them, trust me, they tally those up after a while, and it starts to make an impact. So make sure that you're keeping all of the promises, big and little. Final thoughts on this, what you need to do is think of what changes you need to make. Write down the things that you need to get going on right now and start working on it. There should be a few things that you took away from both of those lessons right there. What is your big idea and what is your takeaway? Also, remember, follow us on Twitter at Entree Leadership or at Chris Licurdo. Also, email podcast@entreeleadership.com. If you want to know more about Entree Leadership, the events, go on over to daveramsey.com. Go to the Entree Leadership section. Sign up for the newsletter. Make sure that if you are not subscribed to this, if you're listening to this and you haven't hit the subscribe button, make sure that you hit that as well. And we will keep sending you as much information on Entree Leadership as we possibly can to help you out. Well, that puts another Entree Leadership podcast in the books. Got some special thanks, of course, to Chris Mefford, our producer, Colin Fatke, our audio maestro, Becky Tenno, our distributor of awesomeness. She is so going to shoot me because we keep coming up with fun names for her. John Acuff, Tim Sanders, and of course, Dave Rams. Thank you, folks. Go out there and have an incredible day.
Folks, right now couldn't be a better time in history to operate or start a small business. If you're ready to take your leadership to the next level or start your own company, then join me, Dave Ramsey, for the one-day event based on my New York Times number one bestseller, Entree Leadership. At Entree Leadership One Day, I'll teach you everything you ever wanted to know about building and growing a business. You'll learn about goal setting, communication, and yes, even accounting. This material is changing the way people view business and leadership. You won't find this stuff in some college business class. This is 20 years in the trenches of leading and actually running a business. This is how our company works. It's leadership training for everyone. When you do what you love with your life, your vocation can become your vacation. Learn how at Entree Leadership One Day in Atlanta on January 20th. Get your seats now at DaveRamsey.com or call 888-22-PEACE. That's 888-227-3223.